And we're back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm honorary Oscar Louis Fertel.
And filling in for Aida because she is a young person who is getting her tonsils out.
She, 11 years old. Yeah.
We have Ray Sani joining us again.
Yay!
As a guest co-host. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Love to Aida and her tonsils. You know, I don't even think tonsils are a real organ. They're just stuff that they would talk about on 90s sitcoms. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, look at her throat. Will Smith's yuck.
Right. Yeah, it's a plot complication, yeah, not something that actually occurs in the human body. Yeah,
tonsils were definitely a storyline on Full House, Fresh Prince, and Family Matters. Probably all in the same week, to be honest.
Yeah, right. It's like the less glamorous Amnesia, you know. We need something to do this episode, so if someone could not remember the main character's name, that would really occupy us for a while.
Well, now I'm imagining like TGIF, like there was like a tonsils like crossover and everybody going to the same doctor. TGIF loved the crossovers.
It did.
Like,
it did.
Let's send everybody to Disney World and they can run into each other.
Right. Was that the Full House episode where like Comet got lost at like Disneyland or Disney World or something? It's like, guys, I'm not that attached to this golden retriever. I don't know that I need to like locate him.
I'm not gonna lie, I low key was attached to that golden retriever like that. I used to think that golden retriever were the like only dog anybody should ever get to. Like, you know, golden retriever is such a TV dog. And I grew up in like such an urban space. You know what I mean? It was so like Comet looks like the American dream, you know?
Yeah. You were just,
you are you crying? Yeah.
You were just avoiding pit bulls.
Yes, exactly. And Rottweilers in the hood in Brooklyn. Yeah. I was trying to avoid DMX dogs, you know what I mean?
But low-key, I hate that era that made us think that, like, pit bulls were the most evil thing you could ever come across. Because I have so many friends with pit bulls, and they are the cutest dog. And maybe what we should have just learned is don't go up and touch random people's dogs.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's the lesson. I mean, you know, pit bulls are the black people of dogs, because it's like... Why we got such a negative reputation for no reason? All you gotta do is be nice. All you gotta do is be nice.
And don't let your child put your hand through a gate at a black
person. You know,
I just pictured a pit bull saying this. Just don't put your hand through the gate. Yeah.
But don't write in and be like, Ray said that black people are animals. They didn't say that.
Oh, we don't read that email. They just writing into the void.
We can't be helped. I think that's clear at this point. Yeah.
But no, we are happy to have you back. Also, a guest co-host into a guest, and now back as a guest co-host. So...
Yeah.
You're doing it all.
Great arc. I have a great character arc on Keep It. They're nice.
In and out of the main cast. Very Aaron Spelling.
Yes. Special guest star.
Yes.
Ray Sani.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. And I'm special guest star for like 6 episodes. That's what they did on 90210, right?
And when you see the cast list on Wikipedia, like, and the seasons are all mapped out, you have like several green blurbs, like 1, season 3, 4, 5, you know.
Yes,
you really complicate the map. Yeah.
Tiffany Amber Thiessen came in and out a lot, didn't she? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good with that.
Yeah, she's Val. She's my girl. She was my favorite. Mm-hmm. She was my favorite. I've just always put that on the record. Tiffany Amber Thiessen is one of my favorite actresses who didn't get enough to do.
Mm-hmm.
And now she hosts a cooking show.
On MTV.
Oh, does
it's
she?
It's like cooking deliciousness or ridiculousness or whatever. So they call it like deliciousness. Yeah.
She had a sort of like pre-Lisa Vanderpump inviting people over for dinner. She had a show where it was like brunch with Tiffany or something. Like a celebrity friend would come over and she would help them cook. But now she's hosting like the spinoff of ridiculousness on MTV, which is like deliciousness.
Yeah.
Mm. She's on the Saved by the Bell, right? And then also... also, mm-hmm. for a minute, she was like the Meryl Streep of the USA Network on whatever show she was on. And then, I want to say, among celebrities who host cooking shows, I got to give it up to Valerie Bertinelli. Whenever I watch Kids Cooking Championship, the woman is really qualified to do it and welcoming and lovely while also being very discerning. What we're giving to Kelly Clarkson, I believe Valerie Bertinelli already has.
Okay. Well, I don't know if black people yeah. and white people equally love Valerie Bertinelli as they do Kelly Clarkson.
Yeah, I think Kelly Clarkson's got a Will Smith appeal in their ability to unite.
So anyway, are we ready to talk about these Oscars today?
Yes. Louis Fertel is ready. Yes.
Really didn't matter who was on the show. I didn't even have to show up today. It's the Oscars. That is Louis's thing.
Yeah.
But we are also going to talk about Miss Caitlyn Jenner. Oh. Running for governor.
Mm-hmm.
She's in it. She's in it to win it.
Is that so?
I believe she thinks so.
Hard to tell. Yeah.
I don't know. This feels like I'm broke rather than I'm civically minded.
Chris cut her off. She said, why you end and keep it up with the Kardashians? I was looking for some guest spot money. We will also be joined by Ed Helms today to talk about his new film, Together Together, and new sitcom, Rutherford Falls. So we will be right back with more Keep It.
So the 93rd Academy Awards were over the weekend. I just want to say, by the way, this is our fourth Oscars we are covering. Jesus, we're getting into Juliana Rancic territory. I'm frightened for us, but...
I'm Brad Goreski.
A smart bow tie for you, perhaps? We're still technically in this pandemic, so they did that thing award shows do, which is spread people out and put some people via satellite. The Grammys did this most successfully, I think. Mm-hmm. And the Oscars, in a way, by putting it at Union Station and spreading people along in what looked like a banquet, was cute. But I think the lesson is you just can't recreate the majesty of an award show at this time. I think that's just the truth of it.
I think it looked cute. Like, there were... cute sounds so condescending.
It was sweet.
Yes.
It was adorable.
This was stuff that definitely worked. I mean, from the jump, watching everyone look like they were hanging out at Home Goods at the pre-show was ugly. It was sort of garish to just sort of watch like Angela Bassett in, you know, like a beautiful gown look like she's trying to find, you know, a toaster.
Yeah.
But once Regina King grabbed an Oscar statue and started strutting into Union Station, and I'd forgotten Soderbergh was producing it, mm-hmm. but when the title started coming up, I was like, oh, this is Soderbergh. Like, that was like an iconic Oscars entrance for me. And I think that they should explore doing some stuff like that in the future. And I thought the layout, actually, of the Union Station actually looked good. Unfortunately, the lighting was like so soft and weird, it made it look like it was like the People's Choice Awards or something.
To me, it made it look like they were at a church or something. Like sunlight was pouring into the room in a way that made everybody kind of fade in and out.
Yeah.
What I appreciated specifically about Regina King walking in was, one, it was kind of a VMAs move, right?
Yeah.
The classic days of the VMAs where, you know, Eminem or somebody would walk in a really grand way. But also, it reminded me of a movie like Jackie Brown or something. And I was really pleased to see that because she really commanded that moment, shockingly, Regina King, living legend.
I know. She's incredible. When she was walking in, I'm not like the biggest movie person. I'm more of a television person. But the way that the titles came up and her strut and, you know, felt like a very like movie shot, I was like, oh, I like movies.
Mm-hmm.
It made me feel like, oh, yeah. Like, I want to be here. I want to have, like, a theatrical experience. You know, my house was dark when I was watching it. And then the TV gave me a certain feel. And, you know, it was nice. And for a second, because it didn't last very long, my interest waned very quickly. But for a second, I was rapt. Regina King is just, she's enthralling.
Yeah.
Although it throws me off a lot whenever she talks for an extended amount of time, because then I start to hear Riley from the Boondocks, and I'm just like, oh, I can't take you seriously at these Oscars because I'm expecting N-words quickly.
To hop off of you talking about, like, it felt like a movie in the opening, right? I think that is the ultimate draw of the Oscars. The Grammys is highlighting, you know, people singing and performances, and, you know, you're getting a taste of the music industry. Mm-hmm. Oscars are supposed to be sort of an advertisement for the industry. And the reason I would watch them as a kid, and the reason why even the conservatives who always seem to know everything that happens in every award show so they can complain about it, the reason they watch it is because they also like movies too, you know? And it should make you feel like this is a world you want to be a part of, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I came to Los Angeles because I'm watching the Oscars every year, and I'm like, I want to be a part of that. After the opening, nothing else felt truly cinematic. And I couldn't, you couldn't tell me that Steven Soderbergh produced anything but the opening.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, totally, totally. Well, also, they kept clips away from us for so long. Like, we kept talking about the vague idea of these movies and never got into what Nomadland really looked like or what The Father really looked like until well into the ceremony. And I think that was a really strange decision. I don't know.
Because, you know, Americans don't like reading.
Yes.
And they don't like listening to people talk for a long ass time. Show the clip.
Also, specifically, now, I thought the content of a lot of the speeches was actually great. Like, people talking about personal histories and knowing Oscar history and knowing, like, I'm the first person to do this, or it's a shame I'm the first person to do this, things like that. But at the same time, everyone just decided they were going to go for 7 minutes. It was right in a row that was really hard to take. I mean, like, specifically, if you're just kind of an amateur Oscars viewer or whatever, do you know how I felt watching this Oscars? Ibra, when we saw the Madonna Madame X concert in person, and you're in a room full of people who are there to hear, like a Virgin in Vogue.
Yes.
And you're like, I know we're just going to get, like, Madonna's weird new 8-minute shit. And, like, I'm embarrassed because people don't understand that they're going to get something that's not as entertaining as what they want, even though I love this thing. I could sit in this all day. So I was happy for me, and yet consummately, in an empath way, worried on behalf of the Ray Sonnies watching.
Yeah, I was, you know, the minute I was like, oh, I don't think I care about this much anymore, was when, God forgive me, because I'm sure he worked so hard and this was the moment of his life, but when the Danish filmmaker won for Best Foreign Film, I was like,
round.
I couldn't do it. I started playing Tetris on my phone.
Specifically, like, had, like, four good emotional moments in his speech. Obviously, like, his daughter died during the production of Another Round.
Yeah. I know. I sound like a monster now.
He couldn't bring it to, like, a couple of moments. He kept searching for other sentiments to bring in, and it lost me, too.
No, and listen, we're all writers. So I love whenever, like, the Oscars pretends like they care about screenwriters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some years they'll even have, like, I really like the year where they had the clips playing and then you would see some of the screenplay on the other side of the screen.
Yeah, and it was like typing, wasn't it?
Yeah. But the decision to open the show with the writers, even I don't want to see that, because I'm like, ain't you trying to get people to keep watching this? Like, we didn't open with any stars.
Yeah, really weird.
That makes sense. I understand that. But I thought it was really touching.
And then you go straight into international feature. It was very touching. And I like the words that were being said to people. You know, I liked, you know,
the intimacy.
Bringing up the intimacy.
The kind of thing that's
talking about their first jobs. Mm-hmm. I loved that.
I liked Aaron Sorkin for like 2 seconds. He usually is too smug even when he's silent. But I was like, oh, okay. You stood serving popcorn. You cute. You cute with Paulina Poroskova on your arm. Okay, you are top model. All right.
Yeah, P.S., I was not aware of that couple.
No,
so when
I
she appeared and was like literally on his shoulder, she's like, I'm in this picture now. Like,
he has a different random girlfriend every Oscar ceremony.
And they are always stunning. Yeah. They are always rudely beautiful. What are you doing, like, man? I need to be Aaron Sorkin, okay?
His last Oscars, he was dating Molly's Game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then at one point, for a couple Oscars, there was Kristen Chenoweth, yes?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, yes. And he still has, he has the Jim J. Bullock glasses, so I'm always instinctively on his side from a classic TV perspective.
That stuff is definitely helpful, you know, mentioning that Aaron Sorkin, like, used to serve popcorn at the movies and stuff. I like those insights because that felt like stuff that we never really learn about people in the industry. And some of that I feel like wasn't even in people's, like, Wikipedias that you could just look it up. Like, it felt like good information to learn about people.
Yeah.
But I just felt that the ordering of that was
strange.
A bit off. Like, to do just both of the screenplay awards and then jump into international feature and to hold off on every single acting category until the end was very weird to me.
And in this case, the very end. Well, I mean, let's talk about the, I'm going to say elephant in the room because it's the only thing anybody's talking about, which is that they moved Best Picture a couple slots behind mm-hmm. and then banked on the drama of actress and actor to end uh-huh. the show. And I think both of the people they thought were going to win, which, by the way, were never guarantees, so I don't know why they banked on this. They mm-hmm. thought Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis would win for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, a movie that everybody, I think, agrees is a B-.
Oh,
so it's like, you know.
Do we all agree? I didn't know. I didn't see it.
Oh, yeah.
I did. You know, I'm speaking as someone who fucking loves August Wilson. Mm-hmm. You know, I started as a playwright. We did Ma Rainey in college.
Oh, really? Did you perform? Who'd you play?
Well, we halfway did Ma Rainey in college. It's another reason why Loyola University Chicago will always be on my hit list. We were doing a black box production of it with our black theater workshop class. I was cast in it. We were hired a white stage manager who was sort of a mess.
Oh, no.
And we continually talked about him being a mess. And then I guess the show went over budget and then it was canceled.
Oh.
which was very appropriate for Ma Rainey.
Ma Rainey's rock bottom. Yeah.
But I love the play. It's one of my favorite August Wilson plays. Yeah, and obviously absolutely. He's one of the greatest American playwrights. But the adaptation wasn't great for me.
Okay.
George C. Wolfe's production of Fences was better for me.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm sort of now at the point where when Denzel makes the next August Wilson play, please get someone else to direct it.
Okay.
Because George C. Wolfe just seems to be translating, just taking it and putting it on screen, and you need sort of like a defter hand and sort of a point of view if you're going to take theater and make it as a film, you know. Otherwise, just film the stage show, because if it's just going to be that, give me something else. And I thought the performances were good. Chadwick was amazing in it, and he's definitely deserved the nomination. I would actually say that Viola, as fucking amazing as she is, that was one of her lesser performances.
Oh, wow.
I think it's an interesting character for her to play, but unfortunately, I think something that's hard for people to vote for is a small size leading performance. If you're talking about Anthony Hopkins and Frances McDormand, who ended up winning these trophies, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no such thing as liking those movies without being enraptured by those performances. Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it.
Oh, yeah, Ray, the problem with that is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, she's in the title, but she is not the main character of the show. She's very supporting in it, and it just has that name because that was the name of her band.
So would you have preferred that they nominate her for supporting? Is that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I guess so. Though I there's something awkward about Viola Davis just having two supporting actress Oscars. Like, is she really a Shelley Winters, a Diane Wiest? I think not. A movie that does this so well, which is translating a theatrical work to a movie space and adding something and being cinematic, is The Father, which won for adapted screenplay. Mm-hmm. If you guys haven't seen this yet, I don't think anybody would watch that movie and think Anthony Hopkins didn't give the best performance of the year. And in fact, I think it's the best actor win since Silence of the Lambs, which was his first nomination back in 1991. Guys, how is that his first nomination? This is a man who was in The Fucking Lion in Winter. That is crazy.
I want to say about the Anthony Hopkins thing, and this is more of a general complaint about social media. I get that we're rooting for everybody black, but there then comes the point when people are like, Anthony Hopkins won this. Like, we just giving this to white people again. I'm like, here's one thing I will say. You can want Chadwick Boseman to win, and I get how much he meant to us as people, specifically black people, specifically someone who's met and interviewed him. If you have not seen any of the other movies that are nominated, maybe you should be quiet. Because it's always someone being like, how did Viola not win? And it's also like, well, did you see Frances in Nomadland?
Right.
Because listen, I mean, that white woman acts her ass off every time I see her in something.
No.
But also, equality isn't giving all the black people all the awards.
Of course. Right. Right. And that's the second point, you know? When it's like, yes, when we have the awards, it's like, start nominating us for shit and giving us awards. But that doesn't then in turn mean...
we get all of them.
Nominate and give a black person an award every single fucking year.
Yeah. I was curious, Lewis, what you thought about. I know that you love Frances McDormand and you thought she was deserving.
Sure.
But they trying to Susan Lucci, my girl, Glenn.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Okay, well, at least we have a positive conversation to have about Glenn as far as I'm concerned, which is she did this bit where they were like Lil Rel came out and did some Oscar trivia. And then Glenn did debut and referenced EU. And by the way, she played it so well, I didn't know if it was scripted at first. But then she said, DC-based outfit EU. I was like, okay, this is scripted.
Yeah. But I was at first trying to like, I was like, wait, am I... What's happening here? Yeah,
right.
Totally. I don't know what she should have won for. I don't have the same access to Oscars trivia in my brain like you do in your vault of a brain. But like, I don't know what she should have won for, but it just seems astonishing to me that she wouldn't have won yet. And that she's 8 times. I wouldn't show up to your party ever again. Do you hear me? I was out here being the old white lady doing the black people dance at your show. And you still didn't give me a statue? Get out of here. Never again. Not showing up.
I think Ira and I probably agree that we would pick Dangerous Liaisons, which she lost to Jodie Foster and The Accused for, which if you watch The Accused, it's among the lifetime year of movies anybody's ever won for. It's not a memorable Jodie performance for me.
Okay.
It's also a performance that you win for because what happens to the character is so brutal.
So bad. Yeah.
As opposed to, I think, the nature of the performance.
She also happened to lose to Meryl Streep's worst performance and worst win, which is The Iron Lady. So she should have won for Albert Nobbs, too.
Okay,
that's a big swing, though, because if you've watched Albert Nobbs, you didn't fall asleep in Albert Nobbs, which is what I did. Kind of a good year, though, because Viola was up for The Help that year, Rooney Mara, Dragon Tattoo, and Michelle Williams, My Week with Marilyn.
Oh, well, then I would have given it to Viola that year. I don't remember who else was nominated.
Yeah.
Absolutely Dangerous Liaisons is what she should have that for. Okay. And, you know, it's up in the air the 88 year, because she was nominated for Fatal Attraction, but Cher in Moonstruck, I mean... both of those are amazing performances.
Yeah, but I mean, sure, but I feel like Fatal Attraction kind of hit like American culture in a different way than Sharon Moonstruck.
True.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. Not that you can give retroactive Oscars for pop cultural impact. I'm just saying, though. I know about bunny boilers.
That is interesting. Yeah.
I think that you should. When we were watching, I leaned over to Lewis and I was like, I would love the Oscars to have like a TBT award where the voting body is sort of like rectifying something
wrong
from a previous year. And it's like, you know what? We should have given you that Malcolm X award, Denzel
then we
Washington.
Wouldn't have to, yeah, then we also wouldn't have to keep rewarding Spike Lee now for whack stuff. Well, we can just handle it. We can just redo all the early 90s shit. And then, you know, we got to stop giving him Black Klansman's awards, you know.
Maybe if you get an Oscar, you only for sure get to keep it for 5 years. Then somebody may repossess it and repurpose it and give it to somebody else.
If you're deserving. That's cruel, but I like it.
Yeah, right. No, there should be. You should be terrified to have an Oscar. It's like a monkey's paw thing. Yeah.
Lewis wants to make it into an actual game show. But I still think we should give away Kevin Spacey's Oscars.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. Please. I mean, throw him in a river, if anything.
Do you think that we should be considering people's behavior and conduct and things outside of performance when we sort of consider their career or even part of award shows and giving accolades?
It's hard because I don't think at the time anyone would say Kevin Spacey didn't earn those two Oscars. They're kind of the definitive dramatic performances of those years.
That American Beauty performance?
I mean, I'm just saying that year. Oh, I guess that was Russell Crowe in The Insider, too. Probably would have given him that.
Yeah, I hate that fucking movie, okay? Give that award to my telephone slamming king.
I didn't hate it. I liked it when I watched it, but I was also a kid when I watched it. My grown-up self was like, eye roll, you know?
That I feel like it's what... There's a specific genre of movie that is your favorite movie when you're 13.
Yes.
Like, you discover what prestige is or something that's a little bit naughty.
Yes.
The number one movie in this genre is the movie Dogma. You think, like, this is so crazy. My mind is blown. And then you watch it as an adult, and you're like, not funny.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes. Naked Alanis Morissette. A lot of grown straight male adults would do well to rewatch
yes.
the Boondock Saints.
It's not good.
Boondock Saints, yes. I just want to say one more thing before we move on. Something that irked me about Best Picture being moved is that the grandeur of getting to announce Best Picture was lost, and like Rita Moreno was the legend who was there. So I feel like we took a moment from her that would have been spectacular, and which of course calls to mind the horrible In Memoriam montage that sped by with the like editing bravura of a Hype Williams video. Yeah. I was like, am I looking at Cicely Tyson through a fisheye lens right now? Yeah.
They were like, these bitches is dead. Goodbye. They press play on a Stevie Wonder song on Spotify. Couldn't even have, like...
You heard the skips in the CD shit. They were not interested.
Like, damn, you couldn't have had her come back up and sing?
Yeah, right. Oh, her, by the way, youngest Oscar winner we have now, born in 1997. Jennifer Lawrence, found dead in a ditch. Yeah.
I know, that's gonna hurt my feelings. You should not have told me that, because I'm going to have to sit with that all day, Lewis. Thank you.
Girl, I'm born in 86. It wears on me, too.
Oh, my gosh. Like, Monica Lewinsky was happening when she was born, and I remember it. That's not good. Oh, no.
Before we wrap, I do want to say that maybe this is helping the idea that I suggested last week, Lewis, which is that Glenn Close and Diane Warren would lose again, and that they really need to team up in Sunset Boulevard, the musical, finally, and let Diane Warren write an original song for it, and then they can finally win. Or conversely, seeing Glenn Close do debut and have so much fun with Lil Rel, I'm like, stop doing these whack movies like Hillbilly Elegy, okay? Have your agent call up Barry Jenkins and be like, I want to be the white woman in a black film, and then get an actual Oscar for something we care about.
Yes.
I feel like black people would also stop complaining about certain white actors winning awards if they're winning awards for being like the white person in a black movie we love.
Yes. Mm. Also, I think that black people have an affinity for Glenn Close. I know I do.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Glenn Close is like ferocious. Yes.
Yeah. Glenn, pander to us. That'll get you your Oscar now.
I just want to see Glenn Close just like being, I don't know, an evil racist in a movie to Zendaya.
No. I want her to have a mentorship. No.
1940s racist movie.
Oh, no. I was thinking more condescending liberal, you know, Finding Forrester.
Love that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
A mentor. So, yes.
Yeah, we need Glenn to teach a poor black kid in the hood how to play drums. You hear me?
Okay. She'll teach Storm Reid how to be in a band.
Exactly. She's going to teach Dominique Fishback guitar, you know?
Dangerous knobs.
Dominique is in a music school, and she discovers that her teacher used to be in like a band in the 70s, did a bunch of cocaine, and dropped out of the music industry.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Glenn Close, sold. Call us. Yeah. We got you.
Oh, when we're back, we'll be joined by Ed Helms.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolette Avenue, which is where Alex Pretty was executed. by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life. And it is all happening right now. Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a 5-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Our guest today is a comedy great. Without him, there would be no The Office. There would be no The Hangover. And here he is today with both a TV show and a movie. So please welcome the star of Rutherford Falls and Together Together, Ed Helms.
Hi, guys. Hi. Wow, that was a very powerful intro. And one that we can never know whether or not it was accurate. because I have to think there would probably be a hangover without me. Just there are other actors in Hollywood, I'm just saying. I mean, it would be different. But anyway.
Well, we don't know if there'd be a Hangover 3 without you.
Okay, fair enough.
How about that?
Thanks so much, guys. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here.
A TV show and a movie. How very Helen Hunt in 1997. You must be incredibly overwhelmed. Is it nice to be busy during this particular time?
Mm-hmm. I do like being busy. This feels a little... This is crossing into like too busy for sure.
Got it. Mm.
But it is, it's fun because I love both of these projects so much. I mean, it's, I feel lucky whenever I love something that I got to work on, because that's not always the case. Sometimes you pour your heart into something, it just didn't turn out the way you thought or hoped, but you still have to go on a big press tour and pump it up. But in this case, I am insanely passionate about both of these projects.
Okay.
I actually have a question, though, about pumping out a project that you are not proud of, because whenever I have covered press junkets and I'm interviewing people and the movie isn't great, I'm like, is this hell for them? Like, are they sitting there thinking, nothing could be worse than me having to tout this thing? I mean, explain what that feels like. You don't have to, like, name any names or anything.
Well, I will tell you, there's this funny thing that happens when you start talking about a project. The more interviews you do and the more you talk about it and the more you sort of like pump it up, it has this weird psychological effect where you kind of start to drink your own Kool-Aid and you're like, yeah, this is great, right, guys? And like it just becomes this sort of positive feedback loop. And that's actually a really nice thing. What does drive you insane in a press junket when you get asked the same questions over and over and over again for like weeks on end, that does another weird thing to your brain, which is that it makes you question reality.
Wow.
It just makes you start to question like, where am I? Am I in a Groundhog Day? Am I in a feedback loop? You're trying to make the answers fresh. You're trying to say new, fresh things, but it just has this weird effect where it drives you mad.
Yeah.
It drives you a little bit bonkers.
Well, now I feel like a ton of pressure talking to you. I don't want to send you into a movie. This is awful.
So yeah, guys, we're not talking about it. Anything that I'm working on. We're just going to go into all kinds of weird areas. No, that's the job. What I'm saying is, like, who cares? Like, these are such little tiny celebrity gripes, right? Who cares?
But no, but I understand, because first of all, it's not just that you're getting asked the same question once or twice. It's like 35 times if we're talking about junkets, et cetera.
Right.
So I would imagine approaching every response with freshness is not only super daunting, but maddening. No, I'm glad to hear it. I've never heard that spoken before. So
it's so weird because it creeps up on you. You'll be like 3 hours into a junket and be like, mm-hmm. I just feel weird. I feel kind of insane right now. I'm feeling unhinged. What happened?
But conversely, when you are working for an outlet that lets you like ask different questions, or like the time that I had to actually do a podcast interview for someone, but the only time I could interview them was during a junket where they've been asked the same question all day. You do sort of catch, I feel like, a celebrity off guard when you ask them the question they haven't been asked 35 times all day, because then they'll pause and they'll be like, oh, wait, I haven't answered this question. And then they have to think about it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be a little scary. But
yeah, I think curveballs are always welcome in a press junket setting, for sure.
Getting to your movie, though, Together, my question is, what was it like being on set with your co-star, Patty Harrison? Because we've all worked with her and love her, and mm-hmm. I would describe her as controlled chaos.
Yes.
That's a perfect explanation. Perfect.
Oh, that's really funny. And I think that's a very accurate description of her when she's in her element. What was really kind of unique about this movie experience with Patty and with our incredible writer-director, Nicole Beckwith, is that I think Patty and I were both kind of a little bit out of our, I wouldn't say comfort zone, because we did find a comfort very quickly, but we were out of sort of our normal routine of like cracking jokes and like trying to find the hardest zinger for this scene or, you know, improvising and trying to riff and get comedy fireworks going. That's just not what this movie was. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the energy on set either. And Nicole just set this really kind of benevolent, creatively open and creatively curious vibe that Patty and I just kind of melted into, and there was a really good chill energy on that set. And I think for both of us, it was a little bit of a different vibe than we're used to. So maybe Patty was a little bit less chaotic in this iteration, but off camera, she can be an amazingly wonderful handful.
But no, does that mean it's not a given necessarily that a set will feel normal and calm? Are you used to arriving on set and it feels actually chaotic and you can expect that?
Every set, every production has its own kind of life force and its own energy. And that's really, I think, that tone is set by the leadership, whether it's directors, department heads, and or producing elements of the production. So sometimes it feels very chaotic, yes. But a really good production, they're run like well-oiled machines, but in the creative space of a production, like right at the kind of like red hot crucible of creativity, you know, like between the actors and director and sometimes writers that are there, that can feel a little bit like, yeah, just like throw stuff at the wall. Let's go crazy. Let's just have fun. What do you think? Should we change this? Is this working? I don't know. All right. You know, and that can feel a little crazy. Then you work on a movie like Together, where the script is so good. Everybody's has like full buy-in on these scenes. You don't show up to set feeling like we need to fix stuff. So there's a calmness to the approach and to the conversations on set. I think there's, particularly in comedy television, there's a sense of like, you're always fixing things. You're always fixing a scene to make sure it worked with that other thing that you shot. Oh, what about this from episode 2? Is this going to, we need him to say this line, or she needs to actually have a different reaction to that information or whatever. There's like a constant churn of evaluation and modification, but like movies can be a little bit more chill.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of television, so I quite like Rutherford Falls. I loved it.
Thank you.
And I was really taken by your character's inability to let go of their own personal history and their relationship to their history in a time where people are trying to incorporate other people's histories or let go of things that might not have been so great for other people. And I was wondering if that was sort of your real life experience in this moment or something that you would relate to as like a white man, reckoning with what's happening around the world today and sort of our collective American discussion on race.
Yeah, great question. That what you're speaking to is exactly what it was, the sort of kernel that the show came from. Mm-hmm. Mike Schur and I first started just having an abstract conversation about if we were to make a show, like what would it be about? And and there was a lot of crazy shit going on in the world, and we just were looking around like, why are people burdened and or obsessed with these historical narratives, which are oftentimes totally incomplete and or totally inaccurate, mm-hmm. or we're just sort of like picking and choosing the parts of history that we like. And for sure, to answer your question, this is something that I have like felt in myself at times, like as I've just been on this journey of discovery and understanding about the experiences of other people, in particular marginalized communities, and some of my own involuntary reflexive reactions where it's like, no, well, that feels like an attack on me if you're saying that. And so just being able to, trying to step back and like, and look at those feelings and ask like, are those coming from like a legitimate place? And then we landed on this really fascinating, I heard a podcast, I can't remember what it was, but it was talking about the backfire effect, which is when, if you have like a deeply held core belief and you hear evidence that your belief is totally incorrect, most human beings, doesn't matter if you're progressive or conservative or whatever, most human beings will not hear the new evidence. They will double down even harder on their original belief. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this all over the place, all over the world, and all over, you know, certainly in American society, in small ways and in big ways, and in like very micro personal individual ways, and in sort of like community ways. And that was fascinating, just that this is a unconscious phenomenon in all of us.
I'm guilty of it all the time.
Of course.
Yeah.
Everybody does this. It's, you know, and what's ironic is that we're so obsessed with pointing it out in our adversary.
Yeah, of course.
Right. It's like, cause it's so easy to see in other people, but we never see it in ourselves.
Oh yeah.
And so that became this core question of the show is like, what if this guy is really suffering from the backfire effect?
Yeah.
And then the show became what it is.
No, I was curious about that while I was watching because it felt so real, so like organic, you know. And I remember like having discussions about certain issues with my friends where it was like suddenly I was passionate about a thing that I didn't know I felt strongly about or that I was still married to. And so to see that come alive on screen, I was like, oh, I recognize that. And it was interesting to find you relatable in those moments, especially over things like your last name or you know, your legacy. Legacy matters to me too, even though sometimes I'm sure things that I'm obsessed with or traditions I'm connected to are harmful to other people. And so.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so hard to reconcile those things. Mm-hmm. Sierra Teller Ornelas, who came on board with Mike and me very early on and really, she's one of our co-creators and the showrunner. She made a point to me. We were on some conference call about something and somebody said something, not evil, but just thoughtless. And and then somebody else kind of pointed it out and it was a tense moment on this call. And Sierra and I were just kind of like reflecting on it afterwards. And she was like, yeah, nobody likes to be told they don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Like right. Totally. Totally. Nobody likes to be told. And it's true. It's almost, it becomes more about whether or not you get it than whether or not you're right or wrong.
Yeah.
And that feeling that somehow like, oh, maybe I'm not as tapped into this, or maybe I'm not understanding this as much as I thought. It's so hard to find that humility sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
But it's just so critical. And it's such a journey. I feel I have been so humbled by this whole project and learning so much more about Native American culture in, in our country, and the conversation around representation in storytelling, and how having fully half of our writer's room be Native American, and Sierra also is Navajo, and how that changed the experience and snuck up on me in different ways that I was like, oh, wow, this scene or this story or this dialogue is completely different than I thought it would be when I thought about how, because of the voices in this room.
Right.
And it's so much better. And it's so much, these other voices in this room are loving this scene now in a way that I couldn't have even considered or thought. It's like, I understood intellectually the value of representation, but somehow being on this project and being really immersed in this, I now feel it in a way that I don't think I understood before.
Right. And the show's also really funny too. It's not just like this heavy exploration of, you know, race or whatever. I don't want to give off that impression.
You're saying, it's cute.
I giggled. Yeah. It's cute. It's cute. Yeah. I giggled or whatever.
Yeah. Speaking of this sort of idea of your legacy, you know, and like even mixing that with nostalgia, I'm interested in how maybe you even approach comedy or sort of writing differently, because I would have to imagine, you know, when you're taught comedy, you know, and things that are funny to you, you know, you're sort of like talking about the world and how you see it. And that's always why people love the perspectives of comedians, you know, and just thinking about how maybe The Office has become such a big thing that a lot of people are rewatching now, and especially during quarantine, what it feels like your idea of what's funny, if that's changed at all from when you first started doing comedy, or if you even approach like telling jokes a different way than you might have approached them, you know, over 10 years ago.
Yeah. My sense of humor, what I find funny, has definitely evolved a ton over the last 20 years since I've been kind of in the professional comedy space. From when I started on The Daily Show, or even my stand-up comedy way before that, like, I've always, I mean, maybe this is just insecurity more than like a deliberate choice, but I've always, my comedy's always come from a place of like awkwardness and sort of like, this come from a place of all the ways that I don't understand the world around me, which I really feel a lot of the time. I just don't understand how anything works. I look at a building, I'm like, who built that? How did that get there? Like, how do you make something like that? Or like, how does this car that I'm driving, how does this work? There's so much going on in here. But the same goes for sort of social constructs too, of like, why is that interaction inherently awkward? Or why is, why are these two people in that come from these different backgrounds? Why are they clashing in this way? And, or why am I feeling awkward in an interaction with someone from a different background and in a certain context? So in that way, that approach or, and like I said, I don't even think that was a deliberate choice, but it's definitely informed an evolution of my sense of humor, such that I'm just so much more aware of the ways that comedy can be hurtful and or exclusionary. And some things that I just used to think were super funny, I would be like, no way. That's like not that actually like causes pain for somebody. And I just wouldn't even have thought about that 20 years ago. My Daily Show pieces, for example, a lot of those are the craft of making Daily Show field segments is a lot about making your interview subject uncomfortable and feel awkward. I justified all of that by thinking, oh, I'm on the right side of this issue and this person's not. And so I can make them squirm or sort of like question them or make them look silly or something. I don't think I would take that job now. I mean, I'm proud of that chapter of my life, and it was very much a part of my evolution as a human being, but I'm not in a place now where that approach feels as effective or appropriate.
Mm-hmm. This is a complete curveball, but I just want to say that I've always found the movie Cedar Rapids underrated. I know you produced it too. And Anne Heche, it must be said, is one of my favorite and specific actresses in that she feels to me like the last of actresses from the 70s, where there's a real intensity and a ferocity that they bring, kind of a feral quality. And I just want to know what it was like working with her, because I never get to see her anymore.
She's the best. That was such an awesome production. We were all holed up in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the winter. She was fully committed. John C. Reilly was fully, everyone just, I don't know. That was a very special moment. That was something, that was right after the first Hangover, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was in a moment of like a lot of turmoil for me in terms of like, well, how am I going to navigate my next steps? And what, you know, a lot of just overthinking and over analysis. But that project came together and it was such a feeling of like, yes, this is a good thing. This is a great team. Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah.
And I actually think, I mean, Anne's incredible and she was so fun to work with. I think that John C. Reilly, it's my favorite performance of his.
Yeah.
Is in that movie. And I had a front row seat the whole time. There were times I remember sitting there and being like in a scene with him and he'd be doing something. There's a scene in a stairwell where he's like completely trashed. And he's talking about these like very poignant things, but in this very flippant Midwestern repressed way. And it's so heartbreaking and so hilarious. And I just remember staring at him being like, this is, I'm watching John C. Reilly like crush this. and he's like 4 feet away from me. This is so cool. But yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm really proud of that movie.
Yeah.
He also is like, he's one of those people who has been in everything for so long. Yeah. Like, this is a man in The River Wild, just like every movie.
I guess I just wanted to ask, what's something that has made you bust out laughing recently? Since you talk so much about like how much your comedy's changed, what's just making you laugh? What are you enjoying?
The show Mr. Mayor.
Yeah.
That Ted Danson show. For some reason, I don't know if like on paper, if you described that show, I would be like, yeah, that's my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. But I wound up watching it. My wife and I would just watch it like, and it was the, like, as we were, you know, going to bed, it was sort of the last thing we'd watch. And maybe it was something about the vaccines were coming out. There was like hope in the world. And all of a sudden we found ourselves like having to pause it, laughing so hard. Bobby Moynihan, who I've known for 20 years from UCB days, more than that, 25 years. We're not good friends or anything, but I've always been a fan of his, but he crushes on that show.
Yeah.
He is so funny. Sure. Anyway, that's a good one. Yeah.
He also just seems cool. He's always on Big Brother. People who like reality TV, I trust them.
Yeah.
Before we go, too, I mean, Lewis brought up Cedar Rapids. I also want to tell you that you are also part of one of my favorite comedies of the past 10 years, which is We're the Millers. And every time I've seen someone on like Instagram, like showing that they've been watching it during quarantine, I've always DM'd with them and been like, I didn't know other people loved this movie as much. And a lot of people really do. I just remember sitting and watching it, I think at like The Grove in 2013. And I hadn't laughed at like a film in theaters, a comedy film in theaters like that in quite some time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that movie has some hard laughs in it. The spider bite scene. It's a total like, you know, lowbrow gross out gag, but it's executed so perfectly. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's a fun one. Nick Offerman's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jennifer Aniston also is so funny in that movie.
Yeah.
And I love whenever she gets to do comedy. comedy films, I guess. She did do Friends for several years.
I gotta say, she's
a stranger to comedy.
Famous comedy role. Yeah, yeah, right.
I think America agrees. She was great on Friends, too. Yeah.
There does seem to be a consensus.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here, Ed.
Oh, guys, this is just a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Together Together is available in theaters, and Rutherford Falls is out now on Peacock. All 10 episodes.
The country feels like it's falling apart right before our eyes, and the people inside it are being silenced.
So we're going to East 26th Street and Nicolet Avenue, which is where Alex Preti was executed by ICE and Border Patrol.
That is not a headline. That is a human life, and it is all happening right now.
Do you worry about your own safety being involved in all this?
Yes, but it doesn't really feel like there's another option, you know?
And of course they use a five-year-old child as bait. And of course they're doing all these horrible, bad things because they don't know what they're doing. They've been told that they're going to get rid of the worst, then they have absolute immunity. And they've been told that nothing they do will they ever be held accountable for.
On my show, Runaway Country, we go where the headlines hit home, from communities under threat to the people fighting to be heard. New episodes of Runaway Country drop every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or watch on YouTube.
This week on Keeping Up with the Californians, she's in. Olympian and reality TV star, well, that's a stretch. Caitlyn Jenner announced her run for California governor amid a recall effort against Gavin Newsom. And if you didn't hear the announcement, you certainly, if you live in California, got those text messages from Team Newsom asking if you would like to join the fight and chip in $3 to beat Caitlyn Jenner. And no, I do not. I'm not on her side, but I'm certainly not giving Gavin Newsom $3.
Caitlyn Jenner is the weird case of somebody who is definitely an LGBT icon, but the entire length of her time as an icon has been spent making sure she gets even one thing correct. So why did she make the jump to decide we are now so behind her that she is a thought leader that we should trust her vision of a future, even though she is still committed to being a Republican and hasn't put the two and two together that, no, you can't be LGBT and a proud Republican. You can't. You cannot be one. Sorry.
They're literally passing anti-trans children bills in Republican senates around the country. And she's like, yeah, I'm a trans icon and running on a Republican. Like, what is wrong with you, Caitlyn? And truly, honestly, I feel bad for Kim in this scenario because Kanye just pulled this last year. I thought I got away from it. I thought I had a moment to breathe. Nobody undermining me anymore. Nobody, and she's just, it's like,
now it's your own parent.
Yeah, it's like, what a terrible stepmom thing to do. It's like, oh, let me revisit this trauma upon my family. Oh, no.
The other thing, too, is that she spent the entirety of Trump's like run and then presidency doing this whole, please, Mr. Trump, you know, if you'll just listen to me, I can tell you about trans rights and how you should support them. And clearly that shit ain't happened. So what is the end game here?
That's why I don't think she means it. I think this is one of the unfortunate things about Trump running and then accidentally winning, because ultimately I still don't believe that he wanted to win, but I think he just wanted to run to make money. And we're going to see a bunch of celebrities take on that foolishness. There was, like, California was always ripe for, you know, celebrity transferring into political clout. Like, this is that kind of state. But I think when we'll start seeing, like, a rash of celebrities realize that you don't even have to appear serious, like Arnold Schwarzenegger being married to Maria Shriver, for example. Or, like, now you could just be Caitlyn Jenner, who's been wrong about everything, like you said, for a long time. And associated with, I don't know, a clown car family of people just in plastic surgery stepping out of clown cars. I don't know. It's disappointing because it feels deeply unserious to me, and I'm not in a place that can do unserious again. We just had unserious in a way that was like too toxic for me to even dismiss this as an eye rollable thing. You know, Mary Carey and all kinds of people have run for California governor. Mm-hmm. We've seen unseriousness before, but something about unseriousness right now is too traumatic for me to countenance any of this nonsense that Caitlyn's trying to pull.
And wildly unserious, too, because her records show that she did not vote in the 2018 gubernatorial election that delivered Newsom his biggest landslide victory for a non-incumbent since 1930. She didn't vote in the 2003 recall that brought in Schwarzenegger. Like, she did not cast ballots in nearly two-thirds of the elections in which she was eligible to vote since 2000. So she's not even voting.
That's embarrassing.
It's just another project.
She should be embarrassed that she's not active as a civically minded person to begin with. Like, you are a citizen, you're a voter, you should take advantage of your, like, rights. It's your civic duty. And then separately, like, I would be too humiliated to show the holes in my voting record and then ask you to show up for me. Mm-hmm. I've not shown up for anybody, and I'm going to ask you to show up for me? How dare you?
Yes, well said. I just can't picture this person inspiring me ever. So it's a pain and a chore to think about. As what you just said is an unserious reality. It's like, I almost want to say, oh, this is somebody who has so little faith in the political system to bring thinkers to the fore. But it's like, no, you're just delusional if you think you're the person it should be. So
yeah.
Right. And her Instagram's with like a Caitlyn for California mug. It's like, you just trying to sell merch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's so frustrating because it's another open scam, and I'm tired of people trying to scam me. Like, I really am so over, like, Trump has scarred me in a way that is embarrassing, but like, I don't need stuff like this anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. And her platform really too, like, if she even has one, it's just sort of like going in on how small businesses have been devastated because of the over-restrictive lockdown. And an entire generation of children have lost a year of education and have been prevented from going back to school, participating in activities, or socializing with their friends. So also, her entire reasoning for running is that saving people from COVID was bad.
Right.
Deeply unserious.
That there was any sort of sacrifice to keep people safe was wrong. Why exist?
Well, and those are the recall efforts too. That's why it's like, I don't support Newsom, but like the people who are trying to recall him, it's all steeped in this closing restaurants and like having these restrictions during COVID fucked us up, you know? And it's like, what was the alternative that you wanted here?
Right. You wanted us all to die?
Yes. Basically, they wanted people who weren't white and like business owners to die.
Yeah. And I truly would rather go broke than die, honestly. I really, I would really not like to stop breathing because you needed to keep your restaurant open.
Call me 50 Cent. I want to get rich or die trying.
But, wonderful film. Yeah.
Also, I just want to say, like, the only Olympian to reality TV star that anybody should respect is Dawn Burrell on this season of Top Chef. She is incredible. She is a queen.
Really? Yes.
Celebrate her. Okay. Celebrate her.
Top Chef Hive.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
I feel like a lot of people have dipped out of Top Chef at a certain point, but I want to tell you that it is still excellent. And I love watching it.
Yes, absolutely. And so if Dawn Burrell ran for office, I would listen to her. I would listen to what she has to say.
Also, just a brief aside into Caitlyn's history as a quote-unquote reality TV star. She's been a flop constantly because I think we all remember. I think, well, the three of us may be the only people who remember I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Of course.
Oh, sure, of course. I'm sorry, did we not bring up the Masked Singer yet? Certain things should disqualify you, not just from running for office, but from leaving the house.
That performance
is one of them.
It was horrendous. My body was folding in half with discomfort. Like, I was cringing to the point. Like, I was contorting. My spine was doing things that I had never done before. She was so uncomfortable. Ugh.
And also, like, even if you're stealing from the Trump playbook, at the height of his doing things to be famous and being on reality television, Trump would have never been on The Masked Singer.
No.
Wow. You actually have a good point. It actually is a little bit too desperate for Trump.
Like, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really crazy. I've never once thought that could be true, and you just defined it.
I want to know how Chris feels about this.
You've actually found someone in the world more shameless than Donald Trump. I cannot believe it. That is terrible.
There's Sarah Palin shameless, and there's Donald Trump shameless. See, like, there are levels.
What reality show was Sarah Palin on?
Oh, The Masked Singer.
Recently.
The Masked Singer.
Oh, she was also on The Masked Singer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And her daughter was on Teen Mom for a second, Bristol.
And Dancing with the Stars, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that just sort of like the go-to for Republican chicks who can't read? Like, I want to know. I want to know, like, what the conservative woman Masked Singer pipeline, like, who created it?
Right. And how can we stop it? Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How can we block it? Yeah.
I mean, I think that might just be as simple as canceling The Masked Singer. Do we need it? Do we need it?
We don't. We don't. I'm disappointed Candy Burris went on it.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe it.
Excuse me. Wasn't Patti LaBelle on it?
Let me just yes.
A ton of crazy people have been on it. That show has gotten people to be like super fans of Jenny McCarthy and Robin Thicke. I'm not saying I don't enjoy a Robin Thicke song, but also like Nicole Scherzinger. Like, this is the lane we've chosen for her. I'm concerned.
So I am an undercover black woman who loves Robin Thicke. So
okay.
Speak on it, Ray.
Any way to whitewash all the negativity he got a couple years ago, you know, with the whole stealing from Marvin Gaye and, you know, maybe
stalking Paula.
Rapey, you know. Mm-hmm.
Stalking Paula, making that awful album.
And yeah. Cheated because on his beautiful black wife and then stalking her on wax. Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm here for the rehab of Robin Thicke's image because Can You Handle It is my favorite Usher song. And he wrote it. And I don't know what to tell you. He's incredible. He's like, he's one of the few people who does Blue-Eyed Soul. And I quite like lean in, you know. He's the antithesis of Justin Timberlake for me. And so I'm Robin Thicke Hive all day, every day.
Mm. Interesting definition, the antithesis of Justin Timberlake. Yeah. I've not heard it defined that way. And I'm sort of, you really kind of have changed something in my brain. I'm thinking about it. Yeah.
Think about it. Think about it.
Well, unfortunately, the thing that actually got Robin Thicke up out of here was the snitching on Pharrell.
Oh, he...
Right?
Oh, I thought Pharrell snitched on him.
Did Pharrell snitch on him?
I don't remember.
That Robin... Well, all I know is that, like, it was their involvement in the Marvin Gaye stealing scandal.
I know they broke up as friends because of it.
Yes,
yeah.
They broke up as friends, and I feel like that is what made his career take a nosedive, right? It wasn't the Paula stuff.
I thought it was the video that all these, like, you know, we were in a very, like, men shouldn't look at young women on camera kind of moment, and I thought he went down for that. Mm-hmm. And then with the VMA's performance with Miley kind of solidified it, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would just offer that Justin Timberlake knew that you could screw over women, but you couldn't, like, he'd never pissed off Pharrell or other men.
Good point, good point.
You know? Robin did.
Robin got too big for his britches.
and listen, I'm glad you mentioned that. As a woman, because I'm never going to like publicly go out on a platform being like people were overreacting to blurred lines, but people were definitely overreacting.
Yeah, I
to blurred
so too.
Lines. It just happened in a certain time when people were looking at this and being like, well, this needs to be stopped.
Yeah, but I don't need him. I don't mind Robin Thicke being a casualty of overvigilance as it relates to like where. I don't mind that too much, but I didn't see the need to throw him away there either.
I want to say, and I don't want to cast away the entire Thicke family because, first of all, Alan Thicke, friend of Alex Trebek. Yes,
R.I.P.
And also the original, the writer of the first Wheel of Fortune theme, Alan Thicke. Weirdly, versatile talent.
Singer of the Different Strokes theme.
Yes.
Canadian white dudes are special in a certain way. You know? They just do something for my black soul. I don't know.
I'm still on that Bieber train, unfortunately.
His Tiny Desk concert won me back over.
Yes, even though I guess he just debuted some like Rasta looking hair.
I know. I don't even want to think about it. I don't want to talk
Did
about
he?
It. Yes, white yeah. people dreads are a third rail for me. I don't do it. Don't engage. Don't do nothing with it.
Yeah. Coachella is not a country, and you can't be from there. So don't do that.
I will say famously, they are often the white people who do, like, compliment you when they're on drugs at a music festival. So they're very positive. I just don't want to see it.
Right.
All right, when we're back, keep it. And we're back for our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It.
Wahoo.
Ray, you're back doing a Keep It again. So yes. What is yours?
My Keep It is very specific, but also totally in line with who I am and my front-facing brand. But my Keep It is to reality TV stans who don't know what they want. Every time Real Housewives of Atlanta comes on, people complain that it's broken, that they should fire this person, that person, that person, this person, that person. But if they were to fire any of those people, you would hate everybody new that they brought on because you've hated everybody new they've brought on that show ever since they started bringing on new people. So stop firing people in your mind on Twitter. It's not good for anyone. It also spoils the community viewer experience because if I, you know, as a Kenya Moore stan, I'm always in the minority of my positive opinions about her. But even if I have accepted my role as the only person who still likes her, it's very frustrating when you're watching a show and you're enjoying it to see people say, oh, this sucks. There's no way to save it. Fire everybody. That's not true. It's not correct. And stop doing it, okay? It's not nice to wish people out of a job because they didn't cuss somebody's grandma out. That's crazy.
RuPaul's Drag Race fans are the same way, I feel. Where, like, one week they'll be like, this season's horrible. And then next week they completely forget they said that. And are like, yes. Wow, one of the best episodes I've seen in years. Or whatever.
Standing online has ruined the experience of reality TV a little bit. And I just wish that we could get it back together. Keep your firing people on reality TV while you're watching the show that they're on. Please.
Now, you know we bonded early on as both being Kenya Moore stans.
Yes.
And I'm still a Kenya Moore stan.
Yes.
And if you're not won over by her in this reunion, then I don't know what to do for you.
Yes.
But I will say, specifically to Bravo and Housewives fans, they seem to forget that they're watching a television show.
Yeah.
That has to be produced, that has to entertain you. Drag Race fans, too. They're always the people who say, this person needs to be fired, or I wish this person wasn't on the show. And it's, this person is creating conflict for this show so the person you're actually a fan of can react, can do things. Yes, fire someone if they're boring as fuck like Eva Marcel or Teddy Mellencamp.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you need someone actually drawing conflict. And I think I've been so mad with people this season on Real Housewives of Atlanta because they've been really mad about Kenya asking questions about the Bolo trip, you know, the bachelorette party, and it's like, who had sex with a stripper? And they're like, this is a private thing. We turned off the cameras. We're having some fun. I'm like, that's all well and good for some of you. And I am firmly on Candy's side of like, that's her point of view. She can argue that.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side, how wild would it be to have a bachelorette party where two people potentially have sex with a stripper and we never hear about it on camera?
Exactly. The show people think they want isn't the show they want. And we're all people who work in television. And so when you are people who experience the other side of what it takes to make good TV, and if we took the suggestions people think they have and tried to make television, you would hate us all for it. It's so frustrating to see people not know what they're talking about and then insult the good product we actually do have because they think they're no better when they don't. Mm.
Here, here.
That's a good keep it, Ray.
Yeah, you did it well.
Okay, don't patronize me now. Listen.
I'm not patronizing you. You know I stand Kenya. I stand Kenya for years.
Yes.
Shall I go?
Yeah, it's your turn, Lewis.
Oh, okay. First of all, keep it to myself. I was on Love It or Leave It last week talking mainly about the Oscars, and in talking about Sam Smith, got the pronoun situation wrong. It's not hard. I just forgot about that part of the Sam Smith legacy and said the wrong one. So but it's just not hard to get pronouns right. So keep it to me.
We also keep it to you because we made our Oscar predictions last week and I beat you.
Oh, you did? I certainly I missed four, I think, altogether.
We missed the same ones. We both thought Viola and Chadwick would win. But I got the supporting actress win.
On the show. My official ballot was not the same. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. By the way, Yunya Jung, what a gem. I mean, the woman could do stand-up. It was really awesome to see. But my actual keep it is to the gigantic Scott Rudin profile that came out from the perspective of his terrified and traumatized assistants. I mean, I could go through the specifics of all the things they say, but like things like, you basically shouldn't move if Scott's in the room. You basically should know you have to duck if he throws a phone.
He's a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Right. When you read all of these indignities that these people have to go through for, you know, an assistant's salary, you wonder, like, how could this happen? How could this go on for, like, not just 5 years, generations? This person's, you know, a showbiz veteran. And it's just so rare that we see a bunch of experiences lined up like this where it becomes so apparent that something psychotic is going on. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that literally every sentence of this was horrible for me to read.
Yeah.
That people were stuck in a working environment where they just had to because, quote unquote, that's how the business works.
Yeah.
My personal feeling is that nothing he has ever worked on was worth any of this. And by the way, he has a legendary career. I'm sure there are people around him who have worked with him who would even say, yeah, he was terrible, but, you know, the fact of the matter is he's a genius. And my response to that is, you know how the general sentiment about going out to a restaurant is, if you can't tip well, you don't have enough money to go to a restaurant. My feeling is, you don't get to be a working genius if you can't treat the people around you with even a basic amount of respect. This makes me so fucking sick. My empathy for everybody involved, I hope they know they have it, because I think working with someone and being stuck knowing your livelihood depends on tolerating them is just unbelievable. So
it's a uniquely, maybe it's not uniquely American. I'm American. That's why I experience it Americanly. But there's this weird notion that it takes an asshole to be successful. And we have so many examples of that not being the case that I don't understand why we keep pushing this narrative forward or accepting abuse, particularly from men who posture masculinity a certain way. It's just boring and uninteresting, aside from the fact that it's abusive. It's just like the notion of the like problematic genius or the asshole who gets something done. It's just so boring and cliche and tired. And we have too many examples of the opposite being true for us to keep believing in this myth, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and unfortunately, we also just have a bunch of culture that supports it too, you know, in film and television. You know, it sort of became
everywhere.
You know, I even had to check myself on a screenplay I'm writing, you know, with like a character who's a boss, right? You know, the default in our brains is you can have a boss who's like a Ari on Entourage, you know, you can have the Devil Wears Prada, Meryl Streep, you know, it's like that has become shorthand for a boss is an asshole, but funny. And it's like, it's funny that they like yell at their assistant or something like that. And that is another thing that we are pushing forward in a way, you know?
And like, we're laughing as spectators. We're not laughing from the perspective of that assistant in that moment. It's not like,
of course,
we're sitting there and being like, tee hee hee, I've made it funny to me that my boss is terrible to me. We're always laughing from the with the vantage point of the boss being likable. And so I don't, you know, it's not fair.
And it's usually people who make that comment, like Lewis said, like, oh, but he was a genius. It's always a spectator, right?
Or someone who's directly benefited.
Yeah.
You know? Right. Speaking as someone, you know, who like has had to sit in an environment with someone who just sort of like tolerates you or is rude to you. And on the outside, people are like, but, you know, the product is good, you know? So like they don't really care that that person's an asshole. It's not great. You know? It fucks up your psyche.
No, when they bring up specifically in the article too that he is exactly like J.K. Simmons in Whiplash. I mean, when you watch that movie, you think to yourself like, all right, this is a version of a kind of person that exists, but it's obviously hyper theatrical, intense. And no, it's not. People really are that demanding and that unreasonable and that irrational.
Yeah.
In addition to being violent, which J.K. Simmons also is in the movie. Yeah. So just, I thought that was an unbelievably harrowing read.
Yeah. Even past like Me Too and a lot of these reckonings, like how many of us have like people we work with, like your agent or like a lawyer or something? And it's like you always hear the shorthand like, ugh, yeah, they're crazy, but they're good at their job.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Find someone who's good at their job who's not crazy.
Yeah.
Also, last note, my favorite part of that thing that came out was that quoted in it was Meg Ellison, you know, who runs Annapurna Pictures, you know, about like how awful Scott Rudin was. And then the report came out that she ran Annapurna just like that and was equally awful. It was like, girl, you really tried to get one over.
Yeah, she tried to girl boss it. Ahead of the story.
I too was a victim.
Every time I see some version online of they hate to see a girl boss win, I laugh. It's a dumb meme, and I laugh.
Did that phrase come from the creator of Nasty Gal?
I don't know.
And because I remember she had that TV show.
Yeah.
I think that might have been her. Who, and then there was the TV show Girl Boss, which like got canceled from Netflix.
Yeah, right.
What an era.
All right, Ira, what's yours?
Okay, my keep it is to Elon Musk being on SNL. Did we not learn from Donald Trump hosting SNL? Did we not realize that treating foolish people with a lot of money and influence and giving them sort of like a platform like this can lead to evil? First of all, you announce him being on the show and you've already got cast members and writers being like, what the fuck are you doing, Lord?
Yeah, really strange.
You know, you got like 80 Bryant subtweeting in our Instagram stories by sharing Bernie Sanders interviews about, you know, the wealthiest people in America. You got like Bowen asking, what the fuck does that even mean, to Elon tweeting, let's find if Saturday Night Live is really live. Like, what?
Sounds like a threat, right? Yeah.
And basically, the amount of grace and attention that we give this, like, truly off his rocker billionaire is wild to me.
Wiley Coyote.
He's awful. So one, I feel bad for the cast and writers, except for the ones who don't care, because if they don't care, then I don't care. But I feel bad for them because it is a disrespect of them and their time and their talent. Like, here's a person who has never acted. It's not even like he's a person who is in show business of some sort.
Yeah.
It is a
person. He's not an athlete.
No, there's nothing he brings to the table. Like, there isn't. It just feels like such a disrespect of comedy and the art, in my opinion. I could be taking myself as a comedian too seriously, but it just felt like so disrespectful of their, you know, what they bring to their work. And then secondly, it's like, we let Zuckerberg change democracy. You know, with the way that with ads and what Facebook was doing with political campaigns, it's like, I'm not about to let another technocrat who is like unregulated and like has this like vision for what the civilization should look like that doesn't require our input, and, you know, putting him out front and giving him the space and opportunity to do it. Like, this dude sends rockets into space. That is mind-blowing to me. And like the fact that we're just acting like he should be ushered in, it's normal. We shouldn't have celebrity billionaires to begin with if they aren't themselves already celebrities, because it's not a good thing to be famous for being richer than everybody else, to not take into account his dangerousness, given everything he'd said and did during COVID and stuff
about vaccines.
It's just,
and now he's tweeting, I do support vaccines.
Yeah, you're so irresponsible. He's too irresponsible for us to be normalizing him and his behavior.
All because of a Tesla?
And pre-apartheid South Africans, I'm just not I'm not comfy. Listen, I'm sorry. If you liked your time in South Africa before Nelson Mandela was free, I don't know if I could chill with you. You know what I mean? It's just a little stressful.
Also, just isn't like the one like thing we all agree upon is that his like personality is a flop? Like, who needs to be more acquainted with him on a dialogue-based level? Yeah. I just don't need to see it.
Right.
And also, you know, I like lose all sense of morals when there is sort of like a hot, rich white man around who's sort of like evil. He's not even that.
No, he's not hot.
There's
at all.
Nothing about Elon that you watch and you're like, damn, you know what? You may destroy the planet, but he kind of sexy. Peter Thiel is hotter.
Oh,
oh God.
His blood drinking ass.
Yeah, but he looks like he believes in efficient ways to kill people of color, so I don't know.
Well, yeah, he drinks blood on his own island with Armie Hammer, probably.
I call him the globulin goblin, yes.
I do want to say, though, with not giving, you know, him, you know, the hype that we gave Zuckerberg to and letting him also, like, destroy democracy again, mm-hmm. I did not know that Zuckerberg and Musk were
beefing
in a years-long feud.
Oh, me
all
either.
Because one of his rockets destroyed a Facebook satellite
yes.
Years ago, which got me thinking, did we know Facebook had satellites?
No. I had literally Googled like last week or 2 weeks ago. It was like Zuckerberg v. Musk because Elon was making me nervous. And I was like, there are so many things in the lead of this article that makes no sense to me. That we have space rockets that had blown up Facebook satellites. And like, what? We have like Lex Luthor battling Willem Dafoe or whatever his character's name. This is stressing me
The Green
out.
Goblin?
I was going to say it's Wile E. Coyote versus Marvin the Martian. They just play on different planes and they shouldn't interact. Yeah.
Yeah, it's too stressful.
This is actually the shit that like makes you kind of wish that there was like a Batman, you know?
Yeah.
Like exactly. It's like, okay, wait, we actually do have literal supervillains
just
walking around, blowing up satellites, drinking people's blood on islands.
How do like, you have permission for a satellite? Who do you petition in space to like put your satellite up there? This is so crazy to me. Rich people just live in a different world. They live in worlds outside of ours. It's absurd.
And then get to explore them. Yeah.
And we always do this because to wrap up, I will say on Twitter recently, The Fabulous Life of, someone shared an old clip of it on VH1. It was of Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh!
And it's like, it's doing that old VH1 thing of where like, it's like a short documentary about like a rich person, right?
Yeah, how much he spends a day.
But it's also from that era of like, the sound clips are like, when they say something about like, he owns like a private island that he's paid millions for, then it has a sound clip of like Flavor Flav going, yeah, boy. it's that era of VH1 sound editing, but it is surreal. It was tweeted out by the user Owen Higgins, but it is an old clip of it where it's just talking about like his heated sidewalk so like he doesn't have snow. It talks about like the jet trips he's taken with Bill Clinton and Chris Tucker. And it's like insane to watch this now and be like, we really love like hyping up billionaires and being like, this is so cool.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Oh God, that era is, we have a lot to reckon for. I've said that before. I mean, the mental illness exploiting of so many people for various shows on VH1 alone, let alone that. So thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah. So it's not cool and you are not being cool, Lorne Michaels. Don't be all uncool. all right. That's our show. Thank you to Ed Helms for joining us and thank you to Raisani for coming back
and
having fun with us.
Raisani, you are a killer. I love having you here. You are fabulous.
Oh, thank you so much. That makes me feel good, you know. I love doing it with y'all, and I hope Aida feels better soon.
Yes, and also, we told y'all when you guested it on with Jaquise, everyone go listen to Ray's new podcast, The Cast. It is so fucking funny, and the deep dives into random reality show moments. It's beautiful. So really great podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Our episode just came out, so go check it out. I don't remember who we talked about this week, but it's fun, I'm sure.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Caroline Reston, and Brian Semmel is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. I think I've heard of him. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week. Stay safe. Be blessed. God loves you.
If you guys like Positive America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Positive America. That includes our new show, which is called Positive America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Positive America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.